extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here!
Greetings, folks, and welcome to Extra Time. I am your solo pilot for this episode, Matt Doyle. Usually the Monday episode is me and Andrew Wiebe going through the match day, but Wiebe, like just about everybody else, is in Columbus this week, the epicenter of all things MLS and really all things North American soccer, because it is the All-Star game presented by Target on Wednesday night. And before that, on Tuesday night, it is the All-Star Skills Challenge by AT&T. Wiebe will be on hand for both of those, along with guys like Sasha Clashton, Bradley Wright Phillips, Kaelin Kyle, all your favorites from MLS 360. I will be in my cozy chair, sitting at home, watching it on my big television, maybe with a cool beverage of some sort, because it is still hot and because I will not be working. So I'm looking forward to that quite a bit. In the meantime, I will be filling out my Leagues Cup bracket challenge, because in a lot of ways, that is what is on my mind right now. We've wrapped up the first two thirds of the MLS season, and the Leagues Cup kicks off this Friday. A number of games Friday, Saturday, and then I think it really picks up steam next week as well. I will be wrapped for all of those in the studio for a bunch of them, and of course watching from home when I'm not at the studio. But yeah, that bracket challenge, you can go to MLSsoccer.com and fill out your own bracket there. I've already done mine, but maybe I'll find a way to do another before the thing kicks off. If you get it right, you could win $10,000. I myself cannot. I cannot win the $10,000, but if you have the winning bracket in the bracket challenge, 10,000 smackers could be all yours. Okay, so coming up on this show, as I said, it is just me following solo. I'm going to do something that I've wanted to try for a minute here, and just go through all 29 teams and tell you what I'm thinking about all 29 teams right now at this point in the season. And as I said, it's two-thirds of the season is in the books. For a couple teams, it's even more than that, who've played 25, 26 games. So it seems like a good moment to sit back, take a breath, and talk a little bit about what we've seen. I'm going to go in reverse order of the Supporters Shield standings. And so, yeah, San Jose Earthquakes fans, that means I'm starting with you guys. 25 games played, 14 points, minus 30 goal differential. A catastrophic season in almost every way. I think the first big catastrophe was that Daniel, who I picked to be goalkeeper of the year, was terrible his first couple of games, and then he got hurt in like his third or fourth game of the season. They have had to go down the list to find more backup goalkeepers, and they have uniformly been poor. So that's one. Two is like, I've written it a million times in my column. I think San Jose is better. Their talent is better than their record right now. Not a ton better, but I don't think this is a wooden spoon team just based on pure talent. But for whatever reason, they are cursed in front of goal, and they are prone to the types of mistakes that make worldwide low-light reels at the back, which is just a nasty combination. And it got to the point where I was writing my column on Sunday, and going back and looking at San Jose, they lost 2-0 to Minnesota, and just start thinking at this point, okay, like I should familiarize myself with the college game for this year, see who the top prospects are, and start thinking about the draft for San Jose, because it seems like they're that much of a dead certainty to have the number two pick in this upcoming super draft, with San Diego, of course, this expansion team coming in at number one. I'm sorry, Quakes fans. I thought it was going to be better than this. I didn't think they would be a playoff team, but I thought they would at least be fun, and it hasn't been fun even with Hernan Lopez. He's been fun, but the rest of the team hasn't been. Poor Jeremy Obobese is just cursed in front of goal. I do wonder if he is going to be someone on the trade block this summer. There are a few teams who could maybe rehabilitate him, though I do think the best outcome for these Quakes is that Obobese finds his goal-scoring boots sometime in the next – month or so, and you know, ends up around 10 goals and ends up being the consensus starter heading into 2025. I mean, this is a guy who scored 17 goals 2 years ago. But even if that happens, there's just so many things that are wrong with this team. And it's well, Quakes fans are long suffering because of it. And I'm going to end it there. I don't want to belabor the point. We'll move to 28, which is St. Louis City. Got a draw this weekend in the barbecue against Sporting Kansas City. Got a couple of debuts from, they've signed three players this window. Two Germans and an Australian. One of the Germans, Cedric Touche, he debuted. He's more of a second forward. I thought he was okay. And then there's Marcel Hartl, who's more of a playmaking midfielder. Hartl, I believe, will be a DP. I think he's going to be the highest paid player on the team. So presumably when he's fit and ready to go and the paperwork's done, he's just going to slot right into that that lineup as Touche did. The third big signing is a young Australian center back slash defensive midfielder who came in for the final 10 minutes, made his debut. And I thought he was okay, but it's super small sample size, 10 minutes. This helps because I've said, you know, we've already seen St. Louis make one big change, which is firing Bradley Carnell. And now it's, you know, up to John Hackworth to try to win the job. And like, that is a big change that it was made, I think, understandably. But I think the real problem, like, that's only going to do so much because the real problem with St. Louis is the roster is not good. Right, they don't have many players who would start for a majority or even a plurality of MLS teams. You know, the hope is that they'll have brought in at least two who would do so this summer. And like, honestly, looking at that roster, if both Hartl and Touche are lock starters, that would give St. Louis all of three high-level starters in their entire roster, with the other one being Roman Berkey. I don't think that's enough. I think that they're still fighting uphill. This looks to me like a multi-window rebuild. And certainly their play under John Hackworth has suggested that that'll be the case. Like, just fixing the coach or firing the coach didn't fix anything. They have been, I think, worse under Hackworth than they were under Bradley Carnell. It's a lot that they're going to have to get right, I think, throughout the rest of this window and then into the winter window as well. I'm not expecting a playoff push out of this group. There's nothing in their numbers. There's nothing in the way they've played as per the eye test that suggests it's coming. So it's, you know, it's tough sledding a year after just about everything went right for St. Louis. I think everything has gone wrong. And I, you know, I remember the at the start of the year, I think it was Lutz Pfannenstiel in the front office kind of making fun of Andrew Wiebe for picking them to finish 12th in the West. Well, they're 13th in the West. So if anything, Wiebe gave them too much credit. Okay, let's move over to the Eastern Conference in 27th place overall. Bottom of the East are the New England Revolution, 23 games played, 23 points, minus 24 goal differential. The Revs have had a very strange season in that for the first 2.5 months, they looked like one of the worst MLS teams of all time. I think they were 2 wins, 10 losses, 1 draw in their first 13 games. Then they won 5 out of 6. Now, granted, the schedule did soften up during that span, but also one of those wins was at Cincinnati. Like, that is a really good win. And the only loss in that span was at Columbus, and Columbus at that point were ripping everybody's face off. So you kind of understood it. But since then, they've been hit by injuries. They've been hit by underperformance from the center backs, and they are now winless in 4 after a 1-1 draw with FC Dallas at home. The you know, it was a 2-0 loss at Seattle, a 3-1 home loss to Orlando, and a 5-1 loss at Philly, and then this 1-1 home draw to Dallas heading into the League's Cup. That leaves them significantly adrift, I think 10 points adrift of the red line in the Eastern Conference. Let me pull it up. Actually, excuse me, they're only 5 points back of Atlanta for ninth place in the East, and they do have games in hand. So presumably if they get Carlos Hill healthy, if they get you know, one of the wingers, hopefully Dylan Barrero healthy, and then they're also linked to an Argentinian winger as a DP who would take the spot opened up by Thomas Tshankalai. Tshankalai has a season-ending injury, which means that the Revs can go out and get another DP to replace him for the rest of the year. So if they're able to get that done, they do have a puncher's chance of climbing up the standings in the East and into the playoff places. It does seem like something of a long shot, but they won 5 of 6. You know, like, they've already shown for a chunk of this season that this team can be really good. And in Alijaz Ivasic, they have a guy who's been one of the better shot stoppers in the league since they acquired him. Brandon Bae is healthy again, which you love to see. And Giacomo Vrioni up top, he has 11 goals and 4 assists across all competitions. He's been very good this year. So some match winners in place, maybe more help coming, a little bit of proof of concept that this team can be good. I'm not sure I would bet on it, but the door is not closed on them in any permanent sort of way. But it's going to take a lot. Just ahead of them, Sporting Kansas City. Actually, 26 games played for Sporting Kansas City, which is tied for the most in the league. 24 points, minus 11 goal differential. Sporting KC are actually behind New England on points per game. They're tied with St. Louis at 0.92 points per game, but they are ahead of both those teams by a point in the standings. And look, Peter Vermees and management has already said, like, this is the start of a three-window rebuilding process. We haven't seen any big moves made yet in this transfer window by Sporting Kansas City. I'm not sure that there are any moves that are obvious unless there's interest in Alan Pulido. And given Pulido's ties with Matias Almeida, who is still over in Greece, and given that Almeida has always sort of wanted that to reunite with Pulido, and that there are rumors about a potential acquisition. I mean, if that comes to pass, as a Sporting Kansas City fan, you have to pray that ownership takes it, because it's the ultimate get out of jail free card. Because remember, last year, Pulido finally stayed healthy, had a very good season, 14 goals, 5 assists, ended up getting a long-term big-money DP deal, DP extension, through 2026. And he has responded with this season where he has 4 goals. And even though he stayed healthy and he's been out there, he's just been nowhere near as effective. Not the guy who led the line so well in the first last two thirds of last season, and not getting any younger. So the big hope, I think, would be that somebody rescues them from that contract. And at the same time, you can be okay with that from a talent standpoint because of how good Willy Agat has been. And if there's one silver lining this year for Sporting Kansas City, it's the play of Willy Agata. He's got, I think, 9 goals and 3 assists in about 1,200 minutes, maybe 1,300 minutes at this point. He has done it while playing as a pure number 9. And he's showing that last year, when he was really not very good, but was injury plagued, last year was the outlier. Because what he looks like now is what he looked like in 2022 when he first arrived to Sporting Kansas City, and he had, I think, 8 goals and 2 assists in about 1,000 minutes. He was lightning. And he was a type of run through the lines and attack space center forward who raises the level of the attackers around him because of his unselfishness and because of his gravity. He, like, his movement off the ball forces opposing back lines to orient themselves towards him. And that gives the other guys in the attack more space to do good things. And that's a Willy Agata that we got in 2022. And it's a Willy Agata that we've seen throughout 2024. So I'm willing to write off what we saw in 2023 as just being an unfortunate injury-plagued season. And now we have a sample size now of 2,800 or 2,900 minutes just in MLS play. He's got 20 goals and 4 assists. That's basically the sirens are here. I don't think this is that strong a take, so the sirens are going to have to go. I don't think... Let me say, 20 goals and 4 assists in 2,900 minutes is like an entire full MLS season for a striker. And if you put up those numbers, you're talking about a best 11 or nearly best 11 caliber striker. So I think in Willy Agata, they have a centerpiece, a guy who they can plug and play for the future. He's still very young. He fits with any kind of winger, and he fits in either a 4-2-3-1, which Peter Vermees has been playing a little bit, or a 4-3-3. Looking at the rest of this roster, it's like the St. Louis City thing. I don't see a lot of guys who are going to hold on to their starting lineup or their starting job in the year to come. Hopefully Daniel Shallowy will rediscover his best form. I like Jake Davis a lot. I think he's a starting right back. That might be it. You know, when Logan Ndembe gets back from the torn ACL he unfortunately suffered, I think he'll probably be another one. But, you know, Nemanja Radoja in defensive midfield, I think, has been subpar this year. The center backs have been, I think, subpar this year. Johnny Russell is, you know, father time wins every battle, and he's winning this one as well. And so, yeah, you're getting the first of three windows dedicated towards a rebuild, and I'm eager to see something happen for Sporting Kansas City. 25th place, Chicago Fire, 25 points from 25 games, minus 12 goal differential. Frank Kloppas is throwing stuff at the wall, trying to figure out a formation and an approach that fits. We've seen a 3-5-2, we've seen a 3-4-2-1, we've seen a 4-4-2. Different players in different roles. Most of it not working. I do think this team has a little more talent than the teams just below them, other than the Revs. I think the Revs probably on balance have more talent than Chicago. They just haven't played very well. But Chicago, I think, are, you know, we know that Kellen Acosta is a high-level starter in this league. Hugo Kuipers is very clearly a high-level center forward in this league. Brian Gutierrez is, I think, a high-level attacking piece in this league. So is Marin Haile Selassie, whether you play him as a second forward or a winger or even as a sort of pressing wingback, and we've seen him play all three this year. And then you have Chris Brady as well. He keeps getting injured. I really like Wyatt Omsberg. I've always liked Wyatt Omsberg as a center back. So there are pieces to build here, but Chicago are handicapped by their DP decisions over the last 4 or 5 years. Gaston Jimenez still occupies a DP slot. He's not a starting player in this league. I know he's a brilliant passer of the ball, and I know he could have games where he looks bought in and he's really effective, but those are not the standard for him. And obviously the Jordan Shaqiri signing was one of the more spectacular DP flops in MLS history. And at this point, I think everybody would be surprised if he plays another minute. But that brings us to, what should Chicago do in this window? Because like New England, you know, they have a chance to climb above the line in theory, but at some point, the front office that made all of these really poor signings, you have to take the credit card away from them. You can't let them sign another player to a 3-year DP deal when so many of the guys they've signed before have worked out so poorly. The track record is just, it's not good enough. And the whole thing needs to be reevaluated at the end of the season. And what you do now could make, if you decide to go in a different direction, right, at the end of the season, in terms of front office and manager, or whatever else is on the table, if you decide to go in a different direction, what you do now, say locking yourself into a 3-year DP deal or a 3.5-year DP deal, a Shaqiri type of signing, that could make the job significantly less attractive and significantly more difficult for whoever comes next, presuming somebody eventually is next and that York Heights does not have this job for life. So it's a tough one. I think it's a tough pill to swallow for Fire fans. And I'll give Heights credit. I thought he had his best window as general manager in the winter when he brought in Kellen Acosta, Andrew Gutman, two very solid veteran MLS players, and then added Kuypers, who has been, a very good MLS. Like, that was a good window. I don't think it overshadows or counterbalances the previous seven, can be weighed and found to be of enough value when you compare it to Chicago's place in the standings. This is a team that finishes 12th every year. They're down to, I think, 13th or 14th this year. They're 14th in the Eastern Conference this year, just 3 points below the playoff line. So things could change, but like, this has not been successful. And I think that anything the Fire do this summer has to be sort of careful and done with an eye towards how this team can actually win in the future. And I'm not sure the guys in charge now haven't shown that they're able to build something like that. 24th place in the Sporting Shield standings, just one place ahead of Chicago, 26 points from 25 games, minus 15 goal differential. That's DC United under first-year head coach Troy Lesane. And led by Christian Benteke, the big center forward who you can watch Wednesday in the All-Star game. I love what Benteke has done. He's just, like, he's going out there every game and he is grinding for his team. DC hit more long balls, more aerials than any other team in the league, and Benteke wins something like 80% of them, which is absurd for a forward, right? Because if you think about a typical aerial, forward is kind of backpedaling, defenders get to attack the ball. Therefore, if any league around the world, if you look at the leaders in aerial win percentage, they are always center backs, always, just because of the nature of aerials, center backs get to attack the ball. In MLS, Christian Benteke is the leading aerial win percentage player by a mile. The guy has just been incredible, sacrificing his body and giving DC a very clear path into the final third. And Lesane's done some fun things around it. They've mostly played a 3-5-2 with attacking wingbacks. And then Jared Stroud is one of the three central midfielders on the right side of that sort of three-man central midfield. But he plays it as a central winger. He doesn't run north-south. He runs to the right touchline to create overloads, usually with Aaron Herrera, who is the strong side wingback. And Stroud has been so good. I think he's got 9 or 10 assists this year. He is a pressing monster. Herrera is also very good. Mateus Klich is solid. I don't think he has been DP caliber. And then you get the drop-off after those guys. Ted Cudjupietro, I think, is going to be a good MLS player. He was last year. He's very snake bitten this year. Matty Peltola, the young DP, Finnish defensive midfielder / center back. He's still learning. Gabriel Pirani, U22 initiative, young Brazilian number 10. He's in the third percentile for chance creation. That's Brazilian number 10. Third percentile means 97 out of 100 attacking midfielders or wingers are better chance creators than Pirani. And look, he's not that young anymore. And we have a pretty good sample size showing that, like, for all his skill, and he has moments where he looks really good, he does not see that last pass. And that's something that's crushing. It's crushing because it means the only way that they have to create chances are long balls toward Benteke or that right side overload where Stroud and Herrera combine and then just whip across into the box. And that's not high percentage stuff. So this is another team that I think are where they are because of talent. And this includes the back line as well. Steve Birnbaum had a really good career. He just retired. I'm not sure they have any other starting caliber center backs. Maybe Mattai Ekimboni, who's just 17, but he's a homegrown player. Maybe he'll be in there by this time next year. Still very young for a center back to be a starter at 18, but we've seen it happen. And Ekimboni is a real high-level talent. But this is, you know, Ellie Mackay, the new chief soccer officer there, he's got a lot of work to do rebuilding this roster. And I think a lot of the guys that we're seeing out on the field this year are probably not going to be DC United players in the future. Though I do, in general, I have been impressed with the level of buy-in from just about everybody on this roster. Like, this is not a team that's going out there and quitting on games. That and 250 will get you a cup of coffee, but it's worth noting because we have seen bad teams quit in the past, and DC haven't done that. I don't think Nashville have quit, but they are in a tailspin that's sort of veering towards a death spiral at this point. Nashville are 23rd. They have 26 points from 25 games. They are minus 13, and the past couple of weeks, they have been the worst team in the world. They have lost 6 games in a row for the first time ever. They are minus 13 over the course of those 6 games with, let me do the math here, 8, 10, 16 goals conceded. They look nothing like the Nashville SC team, teams that made the playoffs year after year. Now, obviously, they are in flux because new head coach BJ Callahan has yet to take over. I think he will coach his first game for the team in the League's Cup. So they went from Gary Smith to interim manager Rumba Muntali, and the first 7-8 games under Rumba Muntali were very good. And then it was announced that BJ Callahan was going to be the new long-term coach. And for whatever reason, it's like the whole thing sort of switched off. There have been injuries as part of that. Big one to Sam Surridge in recent games. Walker Zimmerman left for the Olympics a couple games ago. Anibal Godoy is just getting back to full fitness. These are all crucial players. But I think that, again, this is another team that's going to have a roster that's going to see a lot of surgery. And we've already started to see that. It was just announced today that they signed an Australian central midfielder named Patrick Yazbek as U22 initiative signing. He's a box-to-box guy. He is a guy whose ball progression numbers in Norway have been very good. And that's what Nashville need more than anything. Like, they lost when Dax McCarty left this offseason, they lost their ability to progress the ball through central midfield. And just getting into the final third became a chore for them. And that's taken a toll across the board. And I think we see it in Hani Mukhtar. Hani Mukhtar is having a really poor season by his standards, only 5 goals, I think only 7 assists. He is playing more as a sort of deep lying creator rather than a second forward or a true number 10 in a 4-2-3-1. Now, in part, he wants to do that. He has said repeatedly that he wants Nashville to be more of a ball dominant team. And I think they have been since Gary Smith left, but pulling him away from goal has not been a good thing for this team overall. But there are so many issues with the way this roster is built. Like, they have multiple wingers, including Surridge, who says he wants to play on the left wing and has been, but none of them are able to consistently beat a player 1v1, right? And almost all of them are more wingbacks, I think, than wingers. But you can't play a 3-5-2, I don't think, with wingbacks with this team because they don't really have many center forwards. And throughout all of this is they're an old team. This is the deal you make with Gary Smith is like your floor is going to stay high every single year, but your ceiling is going to stay low because you're never going to develop new young players. You're just not. You're never going to have a lot of the ball. And the hope is that under BJ Callahan, that changes. But they're starting from this is maybe the lowest point for Nashville SC as an MLS team. That's what they're starting from right now. And it is a little bit grim, but a couple of good performances in the League's Cup could definitely change the way the fans perceive it. Okay, 22nd is CF Montreal, 27 points from 25 games, minus 15 goal differential. They've been much better the past 6-8 weeks or so after a really tough spring. Only 3 losses in their last 10-11 games, only 3 wins. So you could see their top-end quality in both boxes. It's tough to string together wins, but I think we're starting to see Laurent Courtois turn them into more of a possession team. They have a ways to go, but again, you know the story, right? Like, after Wilfred Nancy in 21 and 22, he left for Columbus. They hired Hernan... why am I blanking on his name? Hernan Losada as the head coach, and his game model is completely different from Wilfred Nancy's, and it did not work out well. So they went and they got Nancy's assistant in Laurent Courtois, with the idea that they would return to the brand of Nancy ball that was so useful in terms of winning and in terms of developing players in Montreal. It has taken a while to show signs that it's starting to stick, but I think we've seen some of that over the past 6-8 weeks. Nathan Saliba has gotten more minutes. That's been really nice to see. He's a really talented young player in that central midfield. We've seen some wing-back-to-wing-back goals, which is, of course, a staple of Nancy ball. Joseph Martinez getting healthy and being a dynamic attacking threat again is fantastic. Dominik Yankov has gotten into the lineup more and more in recent weeks, and I like to see that. I think there are some trades that will happen. I think that this is, Victor Wanyama, this is going to be his last year in Montreal, no doubt. Mason Toy is on his way to Portland. It remains to be seen what they're getting back from the Timbers, but it wouldn't surprise me if it was Zach McGraw. So there's some work to be done in terms of remaking the roster, but we have seen some glimmers of hope recently, and the team's been a lot more fun than they were through April and May, when it was just really sit low and try to counterattack. 21, Philadelphia Union back from the dead with a big 6-point week. They have 27 points from 25 games. They have a plus 3 goal differential. They are 1 point below Atlanta United in 10th place in the Eastern Conference, and their underlying numbers, it should be said, have been very good. Not great, not like 2022 Union, but still very good. Like, they should be a solid playoff team, but you saw, everybody who's listening to this saw the same things that I saw, and saw the same thing that I'm sure Jim Curtin saw in his nightmares every night, which is just previously reliable veterans making catastrophic individual errors that cost this team points and games. And it spiraled throughout the spring and into, you know, midsummer now, in a way that I really thought Philly were immune to because of that veteran leadership. But Jakob Glesnes, Jack Elliott, Jose Martinez, all of these guys have for most of this season been shadows of their former selves. Good 6-point week against the Revs and against Nashville SC. So maybe take it with a grain of salt because those are arguably, you know, two of the three worst teams in the league right now. So it's, I think that I've seen a lot of Union fans on Twitter, and other social media consciously trying not to get out over their skis about this one. And I think that's smart. But at the same time, Ty Barabo has been a revelation in replacing Julian Carranza. Daniel Gazdag looks like he has his spark back. And it's easy to say after he scored a hat trick, but like, yeah, like you don't score a hat trick if you're not playing with a little bit of focus and ruthlessness. And I think that was missing for him. And then, the back line just looked better. And oh yeah, Andre Blake is back. So if these guys hit 80% of their previous level, I think they're pretty comfortably a playoff team. It's still a massive if though, because the only positive data points we have now from the last couple of months are, as I said, from two of the worst teams in the league. But the Union stock is low right now. You could get it at a bargain if you want to. Just ahead of them, as I said, in the Eastern Conference standings and also in the Supporters Shield race, are Atlanta United with 25 points from 28 games. They have a -1 goal differential. They have the fattest wallet in all of MLS because it was just announced today that they have officially sold Caleb Wiley to Chelsea. I didn't see the number officially come out, but I think our guy Tom Bogert reported it would be about $11 million. That's in addition to the $21 million that they got for Thiago Almada, which can rise to $30 million if he hits his incentives, and the $10 million that they got from the sale of Yorgos Yakimakis to Cruz Azul, which was a 10 out of 10 deal. You do that every single time. And Garth Lagerwey has said on local radio that they're not sitting this season out and regrouping in the winter. Like they expect to make some big long-term moves for guys who they think can be pillars of the team going forward. The one we have seen rumored is Alexei Yaremchuk, who is a Russian number 10, plays for Atalanta in Serie A. He's 28, 29 years old. So he's, you know, in his prime. And that's another thing that, that Lagerwey said. He said like the buy, develop, sell, era for DPs is over. Atlanta United are not going to use their DP slots on, Ezequiel Barcos and, even Thiago Almada's. They're going to use their DP slots on whatever the modern equivalent of Nico Ladero and Raul Diaz are. They want to get those guys who can be the foundational pieces of Atlanta United going forward the next 5 years. It is hard to imagine them getting two of those guys in one transfer window. What would not surprise me at all is if they got their number 10 this window, because I think that's the most important position, and I'm sure that they've been scouting it for a long time. And then they, for number 9, maybe they got a veteran on a short-term deal, you know, a six-month DP deal that then converts to TAM in 2025 so that they can go shopping for a 26, 27-year-old, you know, the next Yakimakis, hopefully with better injury luck. Steven Gregerson had himself a great game this past weekend. It was nice to see because he has been injury plagued. He had both goals and a huge 2-1 win over the Columbus Crew, both coming off of set pieces. Saba Lobjanidze has been really good lately. That is nice to see as well. Atlanta are going shopping, man. Like, this is, I think over the next 3 weeks, 4 weeks, this might be the most interesting team in MLS to follow, because they have already cleared the books and they can go out and, you know, Arthur Blank is the most aggressive owner, or maybe the second most aggressive owner now behind the guys in Miami, but still top two most aggressive owner in terms of going out and bringing in big pieces. And it sounds like they're ready to deal in Atlanta. 19, just ahead of Atlanta. 30 points from 25 games, minus one goal differential. FC Dallas, reborn under interim manager Peter Luxon, who took over from Nico Estevez 10 games ago, 9 games ago. They are 5-3-1. That's win-loss draw in their 9 games under Peter Luxon, and that includes a good and scrappy and maybe not totally deserved, but when things are going well, you get points that maybe you don't totally deserve sometime. 1-1 draw at New England. It was stone cold penalty. Tariq Scott getting tackled at the back post, and was well taken by Paul Areola. And the fact that they were able to do that without all three of their DPs, Peter Musa missed that game with yellow card accumulation suspension. Jesus Ferreira and Alan Velasco both still hurt, but both coming back soon, hopefully. And they did it without Asier Iaramendi, who has been so key in central midfield. That is a point that is precious, and it's a point that they absolutely would not have picked up a couple of months ago. It has them in 11th in the Western Conference. They are a point behind 10th place Austin and 3 points below the playoff line, 3 points behind Minnesota United. I'm still not entirely sold on FC Dallas. I think they're playing better than they did under Estevez, but their pieces don't fit perfectly. They, I think, are a center back short, though Sebe Viaga was very good next to Nkosi Tafari in the past couple of weeks. He's been very good, so I might have to reassess that. But you can tell that this roster was built by several different people with several different game models in mind. And Luxon has done really well slapping pieces together in various formations with a really free-flowing front three usually. But can it still be a front three when both Musa and Ferreira are available, or does it have to change? We don't know any of these answers yet, and getting more talent on the field is obviously going to be a good thing, but sometimes talent can ruin the chemistry and ruin the vibes, and that's something that I think they have to be very aware of. But it's been a good month for FC Dallas after a very, very poor start to the season. Just above Dallas in the Supporters Shield standings, tied on 30 points with Toronto FC, minus 13 goal differential. They've played 26 games, so they've actually played one more game than FC Dallas, but they have one more win, which is why they're above them in the standings. Toronto have been on a skid throughout late spring and into summer, but 2 wins in their past 3 now, thanks to a 1-0 over CF Montreal at CF Montreal on the weekend. And that one, I mean, the goal came from Bernardeschi to Insigne to Larea. Those are your 3 DPs. And there just hasn't been much of that at all over the past 5 years for Toronto, I guess 4 years for Toronto FC. Bernardeschi's been awesome, playing as an inverted right wing back, really willing to suffer as a two-way player for his team. I would not have expected that from him, but he has bought completely in. And now with Jonathan Osorio and Larea back from Copa America, there's a little bit more talent on the team. They, I think, have the ability to brute force some wins. They have to figure out, I think, how to better control games through central midfield. And to that end, look, they have a DP slot open. They haven't spent big on a DP since the Italians arrived. And like, well, yeah, they brought in Larea, but Larea can be bought down off that DP slot. What I wrote in my transfer column, transfer needs column, was they should go after Steven Eustachio, the Canadian national team central midfielder. He's kind of a six, kind of an eight. Obviously super familiar with John Herdman. He lost his starting job at FC Porto in the middle of last year. And he is in his, he would be a Michael Bradley level signing for this team. And I understand that this team spent big on the Italians, and they, you know, the board is probably looking at it and saying, we haven't seen any positive returns on this at all. But like, man, Bernardeschi's a keeper. If they could get Eustachio as well, that would be like, you would have two of the best DPs in the league at their spots. And that gives you such a good pillar to sort of prop up the rest of this roster as Herdman sorts through who's going to stay and be part of the project going forward, and who's maybe not going to be. To that end, though, it does open the question of who's making the decisions with regard to personnel. After the dismissal of Bill Manning a couple of weeks ago, new GM Jason Hernandez was Bill Manning's hire. John Herdman was Bill Manning's hire. And we know famously that both Insigne and Bernardeschi were Bill Manning signings. Bernardeschi's under contract through 2028, and I think they will keep him. They should keep him the entire time because he's been that good. Insigne's under contract through next year. I don't know if Toronto's going to, now that Manning is gone and somebody else is making decisions, do they have license to spend? I don't know if that's the case. I don't know if the new club president is going to sort of let things unwind naturally. There are a lot of contracts that come off the books in the winter. Either way, Toronto are above the playoff line in the East right now. They're in eighth place on 30 points. They're 3 points ahead of 10th place Philadelphia. So it's really tenuous. It is going to be really interesting to see if Herdman is given reinforcements to help him survive the rest of the season. 17th place overall, Austin. 31 points from 25 games, minus 9 goal differential. It's a little bit like 2022 in that this team is massively overperforming their underlying numbers. Part of that is I do think they have just like better squad balance. Danny Pereira has improved a lot as a D mid. Alex Ring is playing next to him. That in a 4-2-3-1, those two guys deep make a lot of sense. Sebastian Giussi has been nowhere near the player he was in 2022, but he's still a number 10, right? You know where to slot him in. And then Diego Rubio as a false nine kind of works well with him. Rodolfo Borrell, the chief soccer officer, he's finally started to make some significant moves. One is Osman Bukhari, the Ghanaian winger DP. I think he's their record signing. They brought him in. He made his debut this weekend. There's also a Ukrainian center back and a Danish right back, both of whom I think are expected to be starters. This team has, I think, more talent than they did a couple years ago. And you could see it rounding into shape a little bit. The left back, Guillaume Barrow, has been pretty good this year. Hader O'Brien, I don't think is a starter, but he's a useful piece. And there are going to be a lot of big contracts that come off the books this winter as well. So there's the opportunity to make more moves. I think that Josh Wolf is probably coaching for his job right now. I think that the rest of this season is a trial run for Josh Wolf. They're 8 wins, 10 losses, 7 draws. I don't think that would be good enough for him to keep his job, but it's very apparent at this point that he's going to get a chance to do so. 16th place, 25 games, 33 points, minus one goal differential, Minnesota United. If you recall, I picked up to finish fourth at the start of the season, fourth in the Western Conference. I thought that was going to be powered by Timu Pukki and Emmanuel Reynoso. So I was dead wrong about that one. It has been a year of chopping and changing. The silver lining is the play of Taniolo Osei up top. He's been awesome. One of the breakout goal scorers in the league this year, got himself a ticket to Copa America with Canada. So too did Dane St. Clair in goal. It's an even year. Dane St. Clair, an even year, is basically Lev Yashin. So he's been really good as well. Robin Lund, a deserved all-star. The rest of the thing is in flux. There's a new DP signing reportedly on its way. I'm not sure where that's going to fit in. I don't think they need to sign DP attackers at this point. I think it's the midfield and the back line that need a lot of work. They have done a good job keeping their heads just above water. And I mean, they got the right opponent this past week. There's nothing better for a struggling team than getting San Jose at home. And they took care of business with a 2-0 win. But this team hasn't looked like a playoff team since about April. And new head coach Eric Ramsey has a lot of work to do. 15th place, 25 games, 34 points, plus one goal differential. Orlando City, the first 17 games of the season, they had 17 goals. The subsequent eight games, they have scored 22. That has coincided with moving Martin Ojeda into the starting lineup permanently and mostly as a number 10. By the numbers and by the eye test, Ojeda is pretty easily the best chance creator on the team. And it has worked a treat. Like, they have just been a much better team. It's also coincided with Facu Torres being left off of Uruguay's Copa America team. And Oscar Breja said that was like a kind of a wake-up call for Facu Torres. And he has responded excellently. He's been one of the best attackers in the league since that happened. The other thing to note here is that even with Duncan Maguire off with the U.S. Olympic team, it's not DP number nine Luis Muriel starting up top. It's youngster Ramiro Enrique, who they signed to a U22 deal ahead of last season, and he's been kind of a spare parts guy. But he seems to have won the job. He's keeps scoring and getting assists, and defensively he is excellent, which I think helps a lot. Because if you watch Orlando through the first part of the season, they were really easy to build out against, and Enrique makes it a little bit tougher. It's all looking like a typical Oscar Pereja season in a lot of ways, in which his team struggles for a while and then he finds the right levers to pull, and then they will end up in the playoffs. Team is probably going to end up around 50 points, which is a good season. It's still disappointing in light of the fact that they were a 63-point team last season. The pieces all make sense together now that Ojeda is finally playing as a number 10. And I think they have a chance to make some noise in Leagues Cup. I don't think they can win it, but they can make some noise. 14. Portland Timbers, 36 points from 25 games played, plus eight goal differential, 50 goals scored. One of the highest scoring teams in the league. I think only Miami have scored more. You talk about pieces that fit together. It's that front four. They play a 4-2-3-1 with Evander as a 10, Santi Moreno on the right wing, Jonathan Rodriguez on the left, and then Felipe Mora, who's been reborn up top as the number nine. And these guys, they have a symbiotic relationship. Everybody benefits. Like, they all enhance each other's skill sets. It's been a lot of fun to watch. Even when they lost this weekend against the Galaxy, they were still so much fun to watch. Eric Williamson, back in the lineup for a few games now, has long been one of my favorite players as a sort of underappreciated central midfielder. If he can stay healthy, that gives them some dynamism and ball progression. The fullbacks don't have to get as high because the attack has been so good. So that means they're less dangerous on the counter, when they lose possession, they are less vulnerable to the counterattack. Though that didn't help them against the Galaxy. The Galaxy ripped them up on the counter. But still, it was all it's almost all clicking for Phil Neville and the Timbers, to the point where I'm not really expecting them to go out and get a DP number nine. Back in the winter, we all thought that that was going to be where they used their third DP slot. But instead, I think they're going to just keep, like they slotted Felipe Mora into that spot. But he's a flex DP in that you can buy him down with allocation cash. If you need to open up another roster slot. So just keeping an eye on that. But this is a team that since about mid-May has been one of the very best in the league. And that game against the Galaxy, like, yeah, Timbers lost. They got exposed, I think, a little bit by Joseph Paintsil. But those are the types of games you need heading into a League's Cup and then heading into the playoffs. Those are how you test yourself and you get to a higher level. And I think that they've shown the ability to climb throughout this year. So too have the team directly in front of them, Charlotte FC, 25 games played, 37 points, plus three goal differential. Karol Swiderski back, the DP nine, who's really kind of a 9.5. He converted a penalty this weekend. He started and converted a penalty this weekend in a 2-2 draw at Austin. Nobody would be surprised if he was gone for good, because Dean Smith has made it clear that he wants to kind of pick his own guys, and that should be his prerogative as the coach. But at the same time, if you look at Dean Smith's game model, it's all about getting the wingers into goal-scoring positions. So you need a number nine who is a playmaker at heart in a lot of ways, and that is Karol Swiderski. He's a 9.5. He can do a lot of the number nine stuff. He can do a lot of number 10 stuff. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if Swiderski, you know, walked right into the team, as he did this past weekend, and just stayed there, because it does seem like a fit in terms of play style. Even with Swiderski, I still think this team should go out and get a DP number 10. The chance creation numbers aren't great from anybody. Swiderski is a chance creating center forward, but he's not an elite, you know, Lucho Acosta level chance creator, and like this attack as a whole doesn't not going to create chances collectively the way the Crew do. So I do expect them to go shopping. I hope they get themselves a chance creator, and I'll tell you, if they do, this is a dark horse MLS Cup team. It really is, because the defense is that good, and Christian Colina has been that good in goal. Ashley Westwood has been fantastic as a number eight. They've gotten some good answers from the other guys as ball-winning sixes. They have a number of goal-scoring wingers who have been productive. Patrick Agyeman is, perfect as a super sub number nine. There's a lot to like about this team if they just make the right signing in this window. The same, I guess, could be said of the Seattle Sounders, who have the same record as Charlotte. They are 37 points from 25 games. They have a better goal differential. The Sounders are plus five. That was plus eight before they got thumped this weekend by LAFC, which was maybe a pretty good measuring stick. In general, when the Sounders have avoided red cards, which was weirdly tough for them to start the season, they have played at like a supporter shield level pace. They've been, I think, the second best team in the Western Conference in terms of points per game when they have been playing with 11 men. When they have been down to 10 or sometimes 9 men, they have just fallen apart completely. It was a weird level of indiscipline for such a veteran, accomplished team to start the season, but they really have sorted things out over the past few months, and they have gotten Pedro de la Vega back healthy, and he's starting to contribute a little bit. Jordan Morris has obviously been excellent for the past couple of months, though he has slowed down a little bit maybe in the past week or two. I do think that they're a piece away from being a top tier contender. The thing is, though, I don't think they're going to make a move in the summer. The way they would make a move would be to buy out Rory Diaz, who's in the final 6 months of his contract, and bring in a new DP number nine. I just don't think that the Sounders front office and ownership, you know, that's not their MO, that type of thing. I think it's much more likely that they let Morris kind of try to win the job for the rest of the season and into 2025 with, you know, getting Rui Diaz to sort of buy in as a super sub. I think that is the most likely outcome. And so then any sort of ceiling raising at this point comes from having De La Vega healthy to play on that left wing, with Rusnak as the 10 and Joao Paulo and Obed Vargas in central midfield. So I think that's the lay of the land for the Sounders. It might not be what the fans want to hear. I know Jeremiah O'Shawn was saying just for optics, it would be great to see a big move, but I don't think that that's in the cards. I could be wrong. I don't have any inside info there, but I think the Sounders are what their roster is right now. And the same can be said for the Houston Dynamo, because the Dynamo have made their big moves. They are 11th place overall, 37 points from 24 games, plus 5 goal differential in the Western Conference. They are up to 6th, just ahead of the Sounders. They went out and spent a league or club record on forward Ezequiel Ponce, who started and went 45 minutes as a number 9 in the big 4-3 win over Vancouver this past weekend. They also brought in German U22 left winger Lawrence Anali, who is a goal-scoring winger, which is something that they needed after the injury to Nelson Quiñones. I think Ibrahim Aliu has gotten most of the minutes at left wing, and Aliu is still a work in progress. I think they see Anali as someone who is a little more polished and can maybe jump in right away. And look, what we've been saying about Houston for the past year now, even as they were winning the Open Cup, we were saying this team, we love their defense. We love their midfield. Steve Clark is one of the most underrated goalkeepers in the league. If they have a high-level center forward and maybe a high-level goal-scoring winger, this team is in that top tier. Well, Pat Onstad and ownership went out and they think added those two things. In addition, they have completely rehabilitated the value of Sebastian Ferreira, who is their other DP center forward at this point. He had an assist on the equalizer in this game. He's got, I think, 4 goals and 3 assists in his past six games since getting healthy again. And he's a guy that Ben Olsen wanted nothing to do with in 2023. They sent him on loan to Vasco da Gama, where he was terrible. He came back. He said, "I'm going to try to win a job." He got hurt. Basically didn't play until June, and he's come back. And now it's like, I was almost surprised to see Ponce starting over him because Ferreira has been that good. I think there is a chance that they should trade Ferreira within the league, because just in terms of pure roster building flexibility, right? If you're committed to Ponce as your number 9, it does not make sense to use one of your highest value spots, which is the other DP slot, as a backup, on a backup. So can they find a place where you could flip Ferreira, who is 26 years old in his prime, flip him for, could you get $3 million worth of GAM? If you get that kind of GAM, that allows you to keep your roster together and add multiple pieces to a team that is already very, very good. I'm not expecting it. If it does happen, I could see maybe happening in the winter, but this team is sitting pretty right now. And I think they're going to keep climbing because they've been really, really, really good, and they're getting better. NYCFC have been a little more up and down. They are 10th place overall. They have 38 points from 25 games, plus 6 goal differential. They have dealt with injuries and underperformance and young guys taking their time developing. The good news is that when they have been whole, they have been very good. But being whole for them means Santi Rodriguez plays as the number 10. He doesn't play on the wing. And when Malachi Jones got hurt last month, for whatever reason, Nick Cushing clearly didn't trust any of the other winger options, and he played Santi Rodriguez out on that left wing, and he played three more more kind of like sixes and eights only in the central midfield, and that didn't work. They just didn't create enough danger out of the most valuable parts of the pitch. So what we've seen, I think, in the past couple of games is that Cushing has started to trust Agustin Ojeda, even Talis Magno, trust those guys a little bit more to be wingers and keep Santi central, because he has shown over the course of the season that he is one of the better number 10s in the league, and he drives that whole NYCFC attack. That is the swing choice for NYCFC this year. If Cushing chooses to keep Santi central, then this is a team that could make some serious noise both in League's Cup and in the playoffs. And if he doesn't, it seems like they're a year away, or maybe even more if things change, because they have so many good young players, and good young players get sold. So things can change quickly, but it's been a good season for NYCFC with the potential to be more. I think the same is true of the Vancouver Whitecaps. 38 points from 24 games, plus 8 goal differential. Kind of a devastating defeat this past weekend against Houston. They snapped a little 5-game unbeaten run for Vancouver. But the good news is that they have got Brian White back on track. Fafa Picot is providing excellent support as a second goal scorer. Reingold did come off injured in this one, so that is something to keep an eye on, because as Gold goes, so go the Whitecaps. What I'm going to say about this team is the same thing I've been saying about them for the past 2 years. They are a piece away, and they show it every time. Just about they meet one of the elite teams in North America, whether it's Tigres in Champions League or League's Cup, or LAFC, Columbus, whatever. They are a piece away. They need either a second forward to play alongside Brian White, who could then make Gall the full-time number 10, or they need a full-time number 10 who could then allow Gold to play up top as a second forward, as he did last year. They need that one more injection of top-end quality. If they get that, they are a team that could threaten to win League's Cup, threaten to win MLS Cup. I don't think they would be like a top-tier contender, but they would be like, there would be an argument to have them in that tier. The Red Bulls are another team that are a piece or two away. 41 points from 25 games, plus 11 goal differential. All of this coming under new head coach Sandro Schwarz, who has changed the game model. They still don't have a ton of the ball, and they still win a lot of 50-50s, but it's more of a low block counterattacking team. They do connect a higher percentage of short passes through midfield, which was something they absolutely did not do under Gerhard Struber. They are more fun to watch. I think they've done a really good job developing guys. Wiki Carmona was an afterthought. He's a contributing player now. We've seen Ronald Doncor come into big minutes after they sold Frankie Amaya for $4 million to the Red Bulls. Emil Forsberg, when he's been available, has been really good. But they have an open DP slot, and they have a need for a high-level number 9. Dante Van Zier has not been it. He just had two goals, eight assists this year. If they were getting like Hugo Kuyper's level production from that spot, we would be talking about the Red Bulls as an A-tier contender. Like that, it would be I think this fan base would be going into the postseason with the highest hopes since 2018. And that is not going to be the case if a player like that isn't added in this window. The good news is everyone I've spoken with expects a high-level number nine to be added. The name I have heard is Rako Simic, the Croatian youth international who has played the last couple of years for RB Salzburg. He is more of a prospect than a proven commodity. He was not, you know, lighting up the scoreboard in Austria, but he really passes the eye test. And given Schwartz's ability to develop players, which I mentioned, it seems like a worthwhile risk. I would love to see a move like that for the Red Bulls, because, man, these fans have spent year after year after year saying we're close. We just need that one more piece. Well, this could be the year to get it. Seventh place overall, 26 games played, 41 points, plus seven goal differential. It's your Colorado Rapids, and I said that in all caps. The Rapids under Chris Armas are one of the happiest stories in the league this year. I didn't give them much of a chance to turn things around so completely, but they have. Georgi Mihailovic has been excellent as a playmaking left winger and mostly as a number 10. Cole Bassett has been one of the best box-to-box midfielders in the league. And now with Georgi off with the Olympic team, he's been playing as a number 10, and he's been excellent. They've gotten contributions from the wingers, Kevin Cabral, Jonathan Lewis, Calvin Harris, Omir Fernandez, guys who you wouldn't have expected to produce a lot of goals and assists are. Rafa Navarro, the Brazilian center forward, I think at the start of the season, there was an expectation that he wasn't going to be around past the end of his loan in June. But instead, he has become one of the top goal scorers in MLS, one of the top defensive forwards in MLS, and they justifiably exercised his purchase option. And now, between him and Bassett and Georgi, they have their spine, Connor Ronan and Ali Larraz in deep central midfield as well. They have their spine set up for the next half decade. Andreas Maxu in central defense, been very good. Moise Bombito, obviously one of the breakout players in the league this year. Whether or not he's sold this window remains to be seen. I expect that there is a number that if Club Lyon hit, he will be gone. I don't know if they're going to hit that number. I suspect that the Rapids would love to keep him through the rest of the season because he's been excellent for them. The one little sore spot has been the play of Zach Steffen in goal. But I think even that over the past 6-8 weeks, maybe as he's gotten more reps and shaken off the rust, I think his confidence has picked up. He still hasn't looked like the guy who won goalkeeper of the year in 2018, but he looks really a lot better than he did to start the season. So there's every reason to be celebrating if you're a Rapids fan. I don't think they're going to win anything other than the Rocky Mountain Cup that they did claim. I don't think they're going to win anything this year, but that's okay because they actually have an identity and they're fun and they're young. And it's mostly built around guys who are going to be here for the long term. And I think the fans are really buying into that after some pretty dark years for a long time. Very few dark years for the Columbus Crew historically, last year and this year, maybe about as good as it can get. 23 games, 43 points, league best 25, plus 25 goal differential. A very disappointing loss to Atlanta United on two late corner kicks this weekend. And it's funny, going into this week, it was starting to feel like the Crew were invincible because they were just finding all kinds of ways to win. But then against Charlotte midweek, they got undressed by a long ball over the top that the Nicholas Hagen, the backup goalkeeper, wasn't able to deal with. And then against Atlanta, two corner kicks that they just didn't deal with, and Stian Gregersen dunked on them. And it's just a reminder that no matter how good you are from the run of play, you have to be switched on for every moment in set pieces and long balls and second balls, all of it. And the Crew took their foot off the gas a little bit, and it might cost them the Shield. I honestly thought that they were, you know, this time last week, I thought that they were going to catch Miami and win the Shield. But now it's a 10-point gap between them and Miami. Granted, the Crew have, I think, three games in hand, so they can make up some ground if they come out of the League's Cup and start tearing through it. And I just think in general, the soccer they've played this year is the best soccer I've seen from any MLS team. And I think that win that they had last week at LAFC, where they ripped apart a really good LAFC team, I think that's the best single game I have seen an MLS team play this year. I expect more of that from the Crew. I think Nancy will use the disappointments from this week to sort of rally his team. And I think, look, I picked the Crew to win League's Cup in my bracket. I just think they're that good of a team. And I think everyone other than FC Cincinnati fans probably feels the same way. Fifth place, 44 points from 25 games, plus 17 goal differential. Real Salt Lake, another fantastic story. A lot of it has been about the growth of Diego Luna and Andres Gomez, the two young wingers. A lot of it has been about the excellence of Chicho Arango, who is an MVP candidate. A lot of it has been about how Pablo Mascherini has changed the game model to be more of a possession pitch control team, and about how he's been able to juggle the back line, which has been hammered by injuries. Like, they're checking every box. None of it should overshadow the play of Emeka Anelli, the second-year defensive midfielder. Weeby, on I think, MLS wrap-up, made the case for him to be in this All-Star game multiple times because he has been excellent. Like, there's a Nagby-esque calm on the ball. You could give him, you could play him a pass in virtually any situation and be certain that he's going to hold on to it. He's not going to lose possession cheaply, but he also drives forward with the ball. He is a dynamic ball carrier and a very good passer. He is one of my favorite players in the league to watch. And as a result, RSL are one of my favorite teams in the league to watch. They are a piece short. And I've said this repeatedly on this show and written it elsewhere, that they need to go out and use a DP slot on a high-level number 10. Right now they have Matt Crooks playing as a number 10. He's a very good player. But if you look at the types of number 10s that the teams in this league have, teams that win stuff in this league have, I don't think Crooks is that level. I think RSL's front office knows that, and I think they're shopping. And I expect them to have an addition in this transfer window, whether it's a, well, they've come out and said it's not going to be a club record transfer type of addition. But, you know, sometimes, like, Lucho Acosta costs like $2.5 million, right? We know how good he is. Carlos Hill was $1.5 million. Hani Mukhtar was, I think, $4.5 million. So you can find guys who are MVP caliber for less than $10 million if you've done a good job of scouting. And one thing about Kurt Schmidt in this front office is they have done a very good job of scouting. Okay, fourth place, 47 points from 24 games, plus 18 goal differential. LAFC with a big bounce back after a pretty miserable week. They lost 5-1 at home to Columbus and then drew 1-1 against RSL. And then Steve Cherundolo said, all right, we're going to go to Seattle. I'm going to drop my line really low, defend with five at the back, hit on the counter. They did that. I don't think it was pretty, but it was effective because they won 3-0. Denny Bawanga was once again fantastic. We also saw Kai Kamara, his imprint, his influence on that game, playing as a center forward who opens up space for the wingers. Well, we know that that's what Olivier Giroud is going to do as soon as he arrives. I still think this team needs a little bit more depth in central midfield. I'm worried about an injury to Ilie, or just if he gets worn down by the end of the year and isn't the guy in October that he was in May and June, like that could take a chunk out of their effectiveness. So I think that they do need to do a little bit more work on this roster, but they are clearly an S-tier contender in this league, along with Columbus and Miami and maybe Cincinnati, if Cincinnati can figure out their back line. Puanga has shown that he is an MVP caliber talent. Aaron Long, I think our good friend Sasha Kleshin just made the case for him as defender of the year. I think it's a strong case at this point. So they check a lot of boxes. Hugo Lloris has been mostly very good this year as well in goal. So a lot to be optimistic about for LAFC. I'm curious to see how they do in the Leagues Cup, because they have made a lot of runs in a lot of tournaments the past year and a half. I would like to see them get to a final and win one. I would like to see them sort of open up and really go for it in attack. And they haven't traditionally done that when they get to finals under Steve Cherundolo. Okay, third place in the standings, 48 points from 25 games, plus 11 goal differential. It's FC Cincinnati, who have gone into the toilet after beating a shorthanded Miami team 6-1 a couple of weeks ago. Since then, they've played three games. They have lost all three. 3-1 home loss to Charlotte, 1-0 home loss to Chicago, and then got buried 3-1 at the Red Bulls this weekend. I think this is a combination of just hitting a little slump in a lot of ways, but also the injuries to the back line taking their toll. No Matt Miazga, no Nick Hagelin, both guys out long term. Miazga out for the season with injuries. Miles Robinson off on international duty, first Copa America, and now with the Olympics. It's been tough. And I think a lot of guys have been worn down. And because of that, they have been vulnerable defensively in a way that is really uncharacteristic of this team over the past couple of seasons. And to that end, what are they going to do this window? They have Aaron Bupenza as a DP number nine, who is clearly not first choice and is, I don't think, ever going to win that first choice job back. He's on a DP contract, but it's not a huge one. So it seems like if they want to find a mutual buyout number, they probably could. And if they do that, can they then go out and sign a veteran center back like a Mats Hummels or a Simon Cher, a guy like that who could command a back line from the middle of the back line, Miazga's role? Can they find a veteran to do that and plug and play on short notice? If they can, I think this team is still one of the three or four best in the league. A legitimate threat to win the Shield, a legitimate threat to win Leagues Cup, a legitimate threat to win MLS Cup. If they are unable to do that, it is hard for me to see a path past what is a gauntlet in the Eastern Conference. I mean, just Columbus and Miami alone, right? But if the Red Bulls go out and add a piece, if Charlotte go out and add a piece, like, those are teams that could beat anybody. I think Chris Albright he's batting like 900 as a GM. I think the only mistake he's made is Bupenza. If I was a Cincinnati fan, I would trust him implicitly to get the job done in this window and to give this team a shot at winning MLS Cup, which I think is their biggest goal. Okay, we're up to number two in the standings, and I did not expect them to be there, but here they are, the LA Galaxy, 49 points from 26 games plus 14 goal differential. Now, it needs to be said, they are actually fourth on points per game, fractionally behind Cincinnati and LAFC, but still, we're going by points here. The Galaxy attack was awesome this past weekend in beating Portland 3-2 at home. They have really settled into, like, they seem to know themselves. They know that they are a possession team, but one that wants to hold possession deep. They don't want to set up camp in the final third and play sort of tiki-taka. They want to sit deeper and trade a little bit of field position for space to run into. And it makes sense when in Ricky Puig you have the second best through ball artist in the league behind only the other Barcelona guy who plays in Miami. And so the Galaxy have, I think, embraced that collectively. And then in Gabriel Peck on one wing and Joseph Paintsil either on the other wing or up top, and Diego Fagundes able to fill in, and Dejan Jovetic being one of the most productive forwards in the league whenever he's healthy. Like, they have an array of attackers who are creating and finishing their chances for Ricky Puig to play with and play off of. The issue with the Galaxy, and Sasha talked about it on 360, and you know we've all written about it, is can Ricky be disciplined enough within the possession structure and the defensive structure? Because when he gets undisciplined, goes all over the field and breaks the Galaxy's shape and loses the ball in bad spots, that makes the Galaxy really, really vulnerable, especially on the counterattack. It's not like their worst games, their worst moments have come from that. If he buys into it, if he is more willing to stay high and let Gaston Brugman and Mark Delgado and Mickey Yamani, let them do their work of progressing the ball into the attackers, I think the Galaxy stand a lot better chance of taking home some kind of silverware this season. As it is, I don't see them as a team that is in that top tier. I think they're a half tier below LAFC, Columbus, Cincinnati, and Miami. It is a massive improvement over 2023. It is the best Galaxy season since 2014 when they won MLS Cup. But they're not a finished product yet. And the way for them to become a finished product, the most important part of it is going to be the buy-in from their most talented player. And if they don't get that, I mean, Ricky is the quintessential raises your ceiling, lowers your floor type of number 10. It's a huge if. I hope he figures it out because he's one of my favorite players in the league to watch. My favorite player in the league to watch is Lionel Messi. He hasn't played much. Inter Miami are first place anyway and are starting to run away with it a little bit. They have 53 points from 25 games played. They have a plus 17 goal differential. They have done all of this over the past 7 weeks without Messi, who has not played since January 1st. In that time, they have won 6 and lost 1 game. They have gotten wins off of set pieces. Julian Gressel's delivery on set pieces has been amazing. They have gotten wins off of counter-pressing, which we saw some this week with Yannick Bright playing as a number 6, dropping Sergio Busquets back to the back line. Bright is one of the best pressing midfielders, even as a rookie. He's one of the best pressing midfielders in the league. Matias Rojas, now that he's back from Copa America, has been excellent. Luis Suarez didn't score, but he was excellent, I thought, against the Fire. Robert Taylor has been consistent. They have found depth in central midfield. They have found depth at fullback. The one issue of concern I still have, even without Messi, like, I don't think this team needs Messi to be an S-tier contender. I think they're that good, except for the center back situation. The center back situation has been the issue all year long. And it's not that they are bad without the ball. It's that they are imprecise and slow with it. For this team to be, I think, what they want to be and what they need to be, a team that dominates field position via possession, they need better from Toto Aviles and Sergei Kristoff. The other option is playing Busquets there more often, which they have done, I think, more out of injury necessity in recent weeks. I don't love that. I think just physically, there are too many center backs who can overwhelm Busquets. The good news is that they do appear to be adding a River Plate center back on loan for the next year. The name of the center back is escaping me right now because I'm a very stupid man who did not write it down. So I'm actually scrolling to try to find the name while I'm filibustering for time. But anyway, the idea is to get a center back who is able to hold up defensively, but is also able to distribute and break lines with his passing, so that the sort of 3-2-2-3 attacking shape that Tata Martino wants to use in possession can be the default. And if you look at the way Miami play, too often they've struggled to get into that shape, which has, I think, limited their ability to dominate games in the way that, say, the Crew have dominated games. I think if you were to put is David Martinez, thank you, is the center back from River Plate. He's a Paraguay international. They're expected to get him on a loan, which has a purchase option in summer of 2025. Miami, to be their best, need to look more like the Columbus Crew. Miami probably have enough, like, they have enough talent to win stuff even if they don't hit that level. They won Leagues Cup last year, and they were a worse team last year than they are now. All right, so they could not become the platonic ideal of a Tata Martino team and still win multiple trophies anyway, because the talent is just absurd on this team. But in order for them to be the team they want to be, they need David Martinez to get here, to slot into the lineup, and to take control of games from the back line in the way that we see Malte Amundsen, Rudy Camacho, Steven Moreira take control of games from the back line for Columbus. I don't think they're going to be as dynamic. David Martinez is not going to be, you know, underlapping and ending up in the box the way Steven Moreira does. But if you watch Columbus games, a lot of the way the game moves is dictated by those center backs. And Miami just haven't had that all year. They think they're going out and they're getting a guy who can do that. If they have, in fact, done that, Miami might win three trophies, man. Like, this team, they already look a very good bet for the Supporters' Shield. This past week, they, you know, created some separation and did so even without Messi. They will probably have Messi back once league play picks up again. And if they have a elite center back as well, it might be lights out for the rest of MLS. That's what we're talking about here with this team in 2024. Okay, this went much longer than I thought it was. I thought I was going to be done in 45 minutes, but I can never shut up. It was fun. It was fun to do this for the first time. Going to take some important lessons. Hopefully you didn't fall asleep and drive into a ditch while listening to this. And don't forget, it is the MLS All-Star Game presented by Target on Wednesday night, and it is the All-Star Skills Challenge by AT&T on Tuesday night. And get over to MLSsoccer.com and fill out your League's Cup bracket challenge as well. I got a chance to win $10,000. I think Weeby is going to be back on Thursday. I'm not sure of the exact schedule, but I think Weeby is going to be back on Thursday, and maybe it'll be the two of us on that one, and we'll use that as a chance to break down the League's Cup. Thank you for indulging me and humoring me. I had a good time doing this, and we'll see you again real soon. Take care.